This evening, Deborah and sisters, we are to have an address entitled The Gibeonite Deception, based on Joshua chapter 9. Now, Brother James Wharton has kindly consented to lead us in that reading. Thank you, Brother James. So, before considering the actual actions of the Gibeonites, it may well be worthwhile examining the background to this incident that we're to look at. Our readings from Joshua over the past 7 days have covered the appointment of Joshua by God to bring Israel into the Promised Land, and then the sending out of the spies, the crossing of the Jordan, the rite of circumcision renewed at Gilgal, the fall of Jericho, and then the failure of Israel to take Ai due to Achan's sin. Chapter 8 then details the second successful attempt on Ai once Achan had been dealt with, and concludes with the covenant renewed on Mount Ebal, with the blessings recited from that mountain and the curses from neighbouring Mount Gerizim, as required by Moses in Deuteronomy. Thus far, the Israelites had only taken a tiny fraction of the Promised Land, but there is no doubt that their reputation was causing fear and panic amongst the Canaanite inhabitants. Indeed, even before they'd set a foot west of the Jordan, the spies who went to Jericho were told this by Rahab, Joshua chapter 2 and verse 9. And Rahab said unto the men, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what he did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. As soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. So the fall of Jericho and Ai that had been expected by the Canaanites forced the remaining kings of Canaan to convene a conference to discuss how to oppose Joshua's army. And their answer to this problem was to get together into a large confederacy, as we read in the first two verses of our chapter 9 tonight. And it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills and in the valleys and in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite heard thereof, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. Yes, they were uniting together to fight against Israel, to put a stop once and for all to this invasion. Now, we must remember that at this time, Canaan was not a single nation, but a collection of small city-states ruled over by really quite local kings. And on their own, therefore, these cities were not especially powerful, as they must have had limited resources and would have felt very vulnerable to any powerful invader. Indeed, it would appear that at this time, that these city-states often fought against each other, with the occasional support of more powerful states such as Egypt to the south or the Mesopotamian nations to the north. So therefore, the fact that so many of these kings were allying themselves together and maybe sinking their differences shows just how seriously they took the threat of the Israelites. The land of Canaan has long served as a buffer zone between the main Middle Eastern civilizations based on the Nile and the Euphrates. And it was in the interest of these major powers for Canaan to remain a divided territory, ruled over by minor kings, many of whom, as we said, were clients of their more powerful neighbors. But with the waning of Egypt's power in the wake of the plagues, some 4 decades before, these Canaanite city-states were vulnerable to attack, as they had no major ally to support them. They were pretty much left adrift on their own. And I'm sure that this state of affairs was providentially arranged by God to ease Israel's entry into the land. So the Canaanites formed this sort of grand alliance to fight against Joshua. But one city, Gibeon, chose an alternative strategy. To their Canaanite neighbours, it looked like cowardice, but in the end, the Gibeonites, for all their faults, were one of the very few Canaanite people to survive after the other kings that chose confrontation with Joshua were completely annihilated. So, what do we know about Gibeon and its inhabitants? Gibeon was an important town in the southern hill country of Canaan, situated a little way to the northeast of Jerusalem, above the Jordan Valley, and is known today by its Arab name of El Jib. We learn from the next chapter, chapter 10 and verse 2, that Gibeon was a significant city among the Canaanites. We read, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. So it was larger than Ai, possessed a formidable army, and it would appear from verse 17 of Joshua chapter 9 that the Gibeonite clan occupied several other cities, of which Gibeon was the chief, which was probably typical of the socio-political setup in Canaan at the time, of sort of local clans presiding over a territory encompassing several towns and cities. Verse seven, of chapter 9 tells us that the Gibeonites were Hivites. That's probably just worth spending a few moments thinking about the Hivites as a people. They are mentioned in the table of nations in Genesis chapter 10 as being descended from the sons of Canaan, and therefore descended from Noah's son Ham. And we will recall that the descendants of Ham were cursed by Noah to become servants, a fact that we should observe came true in this incident, and indeed some others that we'll just mention. It would appear that the ancestral Hivite territory was in the northern Fertile Crescent to the northeast of Syria. But by the time of Joshua, Hivites had long been living in the land of Canaan, with their principal locations being the mountains of Lebanon, extending as far south as the Hermon Range and the valley leading to Hamath, as we read in Joshua chapter 11 and verse 3. No need particularly to turn it up. But they were obviously a distinct people, this being apparent much later on during the time of David, who included them in his fatal numbering of the people, as recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 24. They were still a distinct people all those centuries later. And much earlier, during the time of the patriarchs, Genesis 34 tells the account of how Dinah, Jacob's daughter, was raped by the prince of Shechem, whose people, we learn from this passage, were Hivites. And following this incident, the rulers of Shechem took an alliance with Jacob, but were tricked into circumcising all their men as a token of a covenant, so incapacitating themselves. Dinah's brothers then took advantage of the Shechemites' incapacity to massacre them in revenge for violating their sister. And I thought it was maybe just a little bit ironic that these Hivites of three or four centuries before the ones we're looking at now were duped by Israel, rather than what we're looking at today was the other way around, of course. But again, it maybe reinforces the lesson that the Hivites were part of a cursed nation of people who the Israelites were expressly forbidden to make alliances with. So returning to the time of Joshua, it would appear that the Hivites of Gibeon were ruled by a council of elders rather than an absolute king. Verse 11, for example, of chapter 9, the envoys said, "Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying," so forth and so forth. This seems to maybe have allowed the people of Gibeon more of a voice in their affairs than we might have expected at this time, which perhaps explains their somewhat prudent tactic of avoiding direct conflict with Israel. It was a bold and indeed a clever tactic, which ultimately, as we said, preserved their lives, if not their liberty. Verse 3 of chapter 9. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work wilily, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles, old and rent, and bound up, and old shoes, and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and mouldy. Yes, they didn't really leave any details to chance. They did their homework, as it were, and put on a good act. And then, verse 6, they went to Joshua, unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, We be come from a far country, now therefore make ye a league with us. Yes, it must have taken some courage to apparently casually walk into the Israelite camp and effectively demand that they make a treaty with them. They must have known that they would have been killed had the truth been discovered there and then. They claimed, as I say, to be from a far country, a term that suggests a location well beyond the promised land of Canaan. For example, the Hebrew word here translated far is the same as that used by Hezekiah to describe Babylonia, where envoys from that country came to visit him after he had been ill. We remember the passage in Isaiah that describes that. So it gives the impression of being a long way away. Maybe they were trying to pass themselves off as Babylonians or some such people. But anyway, the Gibeonites hoped that Joshua would not see the need to totally destroy them if he believed that they were from a long way off, but rather be willing to make a treaty with them. Now we have to remember, of course, that the Canaanites' nations were to be utterly destroyed by the Israelites. That was God's clear command. There could be no compromise, no coexistence in the land between Israel and the Canaanites. Any attempt to live alongside these nations in friendship would be spiritually fatal for Israel. And this was set out very clearly in Exodus chapter 23, where the Lord, speaking through Moses, gave the Israelites clear instructions about what they were to do when they entered the promised land. Exodus chapter 23 and verse 23. Those of you who were at Red Hill on Sunday will recall that Brother Ian mentioned this verse, but it's probably worthwhile looking at it again. For mine angel shall go before thee and bring thee in unto the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. Yes, pretty uncompromising stuff. And then verse 32, Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. One wonders indeed whether the inhabitants of Canaan had heard of this instruction. Otherwise, it's maybe a little hard to account for why they were just so terrified of Israel. As we read Rahab's words, that the strength had completely gone out of them, that the confidence was just at rock bottom. And we wonder whether they knew that this, I suppose what we'd almost today call ethnic cleansing, was in store for them if Israel got into the land. And of course, an enemy demoralized is an enemy already half defeated. So again, this was another way in which God was helping his people Israel conquer the land by giving them this sort of ethos of invincibility and power. Interestingly enough, God did not impose a total ban on Israel forming friendships with those nations living outside the promised land. There's nowhere I can think of where Israel was commanded to destroy nations from afar, not necessarily, unless, of course, they were proving hostile to Israel. Indeed, it was recognized that the prosperity and blessings afforded to Israel, if they were faithful to God, might claim the attention and admiration of some outside nations. For example, just turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 6. Speaking of the law, Moses says, "Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who hath God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" And there's nowhere in this passage that commands Israel to turn such inquirers away, much less attack them if they came with the right motives. And indeed, throughout Israel's history, there were times when Gentiles did come to recognize the God of Israel and to admire his people. Examples include Hiram, the Queen of Sheba, and those Babylonian envoys who came to see Hezekiah. And so maybe the Gibeonites thought that they could trick into Israel into believing that they were from a far land and therefore be received as friends rather than enemies. But, and this is a very important but, Gibeon's motivation was one of self-preservation, solely self-preservation. It was not born of a genuine interest in learning about God's ways. It was not honest. It relied on deceit for its success. They told brazen lies as to who they were and how old or otherwise their provisions had become. And so, despite the Gibeonites' carefully managed deception of old clothes and stale bread and perished wineskins, it is evident from verse 7 that Israel was suspicious. "And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, Peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you?" Perhaps they looked too like Canaanites to be plausibly, say, from Babylonia or some other such country. Joshua pressed the point in verse 8. "Joshua said unto them, Who are ye, and whence come ye?" And then they give this rather evasive answer. "From a far country thy servants have come, because of the name of the Lord thy God. We have heard the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt," etc. Yes, they used a bit of flattery, didn't they? They recounted the Israelites' exploits against Og and Sihon, verse 10, "and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth." They then invited the Israelites to sample their mouldy bread and look closely at their old clothes and shoes, supposedly worn out by a long journey. Verses 12 and 13, for example. The Gibeonites' deception worked. Israel was taken in by the evidence of their eyes and did not think to ask God for guidance. Indeed, even Joshua fell for the trick. He made a legally binding peace treaty with them in verse 14 and 15. "And the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live. And the congregation, and the princes of the congregation swear unto them." It's quite strange, isn't it, why Joshua behaved like this. Why did he make this treaty with the Gibeonites? We've noted that the Israelites seemed unsure about how genuine the Gibeonites' claims were. So it seems amazing to me that they did not seek God's help in this matter, especially that they had the means through the Urim and Thummim to ask God directly. From what we've read, they must have been very close to God at this time. They had just renewed the covenant on Mount Ebal, and they had seen God fight for them against Jericho and Ai. So how come they just made this rather elementary mistake of not seeking God, who they knew was close to them? Well, surely here is a lesson for us, isn't there, how we should not always rely on our own human instincts to form judgments, but always seek for God's guidance, especially when making important decisions. Of course, for us, it is not quite as straightforward as for Joshua. We have no open vision, as it were, to help us decide matters. But what we do have is many examples in the scripture to help us. Examples, of course, that Joshua didn't have. We have a far more wide selection of examples than he did. And of course, we certainly do have prayer. And we know that although we will not be answered directly, like in olden times, if we approach God in faith, he will so often provide us with clear indicators that are enough to those who have the faith to discern them about what direction we should take in our lives. Three days later, after the treaty had been made, the Israelites learned that their new allies, supposedly from a far land, were in fact local Canaanites. Verse 16. And it came to pass at the end of 3 days, after they had made a league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbours and that they dwelt among them. We can only imagine the Israelites' frustration and the self-kicking that must have gone on. Verse 17, and the children of Israel journeyed and came unto their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Chephirah and Beeroth and Kirjath-Jearim. The children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured against the princes. Yes, we can imagine the frustration of the people of Israel when they learnt that the mistake that their leaders had made. And so, given the embarrassing predicament that they found themselves in, the Israelites did indeed need to visit the Gibeonites to review the situation. It's clear that they could not remain on a treaty of friendship of equal terms after they had found out about the deception. But the Israelites did not attempt to attack them. They kept their treaty that far. They protected the Gibeonites' safety. Indeed, as we've seen, the Israelites' anger was reserved for their own leaders. And the Israelite elders' response was the only possible correct one. Verse 19, but all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. Yes, Israel had made a treaty to the Gibeonites in God's name. They could not simply go back on it and tear it up. God keeps his promises. He is faithful, and so must those be who bear his name. To have done otherwise would have made God out to be a liar, and so the Israelites would have brought wrath on themselves. And so here surely is another lesson for us who claim to bear the name of God, to ensure we always act consistently to our profession, that we show God to be true and faithful by our own actions in our lives. But as we said, Israel could not just leave the terms of the treaty with Gibeon as it was. The Gibeonites had obtained the friendship and protection of Israel by deceit. And as such, while Israel were obliged to refrain from attacking the Gibeonites, they could no longer be regarded as equal partners. And the only solution was to let them live, but to enslave them. Verse 20, this we will do to them, we will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us. Yes, wrath from God, because of the oath which we swear unto them. And the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised them. And so the Gibeonites became menial servants for the Israelites, carrying their wood and their water, and also serving the house of God, as described in verse 23. Now therefore ye are cursed, And there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. Despite their error of judgment, the Israelites under Joshua acted very honourably by keeping the Gibeonites alive. And indeed, in chapter 10, we learn of how Joshua, in fulfilment of his treaty of protection, came to the rescue of Gibeon when it was attacked by the five kings of the Amorites in revenge for them turning traitor. Chapter 10, verse 5. Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their hosts, and encamped before Gibeon and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp to Gilgal, saying, Slack not thy hand from thy servants, come up to us quickly and save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valour. As we read on in the rest of this chapter 10, we see how God turned this attack on Gibeon by their neighbours to Israel's advantage. Because Joshua was able to engage all five kings of the Amorites at one time, and we've got helping by pounding the fleeing armies of hailstones, these Amorite armies were completely destroyed in one stroke, paving the way for Israel to conquer all of the promised land. But the Gibeonites survived. They remained living in the land long after their Amorite neighbours had been destroyed. We read of them being used, for example, by Solomon as conscript labour many centuries after these events. But although they had kept themselves alive, the Gibeonites remained as humble, menial servants to God's people, in marked contrast to the strong, self-reliant, royal-like people they had once been. And so, in conclusion, is there any significance for us in these events? What can we learn from them? Well, we've already noted that we should learn to rely on God, not ourselves, and that we who profess to have taken on God's name should act in accordance with that profession, just as Joshua did, even if it hurts us sometimes, even if it's to our temporary disadvantage. I'm sure in so many ways Joshua would have liked to have been rid of the Gibeonites. They were a possible source of temptation and general sort of diluting of the promised land, but yet he knew that he had to live with them because he had made a mistake and he had to live with the consequences. And so sometimes we too are called upon to suffer inconvenience or worse for the sake of the gospel that we've been called to. And so do we cheerfully accept that if that comes upon us, or do we try and fight against it? I think Joshua provides a good example of the right course of action for us. As for any typical significance in these events, we wondered at first whether the Gibeonites in any way represented the Gentiles coming to accept Christ, the antitypical Joshua. But I think the type soon breaks down when we consider that the covenant that Joshua made with the Gibeonites was based on a pretense rather than a humble acknowledgement of the truth. As we've already made the point, they came to Joshua not out of any real love for God, but out of fear, so they employed a desperate ploy to avoid certain defeat. Verse 24 of chapter 9. And they answered Joshua, the Gibeonites, and said, Because it was certainly told thy servants how that the Lord thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all this land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you, therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you, and have done this thing. Had the Gibeonites come honestly and expressed a wish to turn from their idols and shown faith in the Lord, as for example Rahab, who we looked at the beginning, did, then the outcome might have been very different. But of course that was not the Lord's will for that to happen, and that is somewhat a counterfactual argument, but I think the point has been made that certain Gentiles, even in Old Testament times, did come to worship and acknowledge God, as we've mentioned, And I suppose in theory, there's no reason why the Gibeonites couldn't have done the same. But while their deceit ensured that they saved their lives, they ended up as bond slaves to Israel and certainly not equal heirs to the land. And so, our concluding thought must be that we, dear brothers and sisters, have a very different relationship to the latter-day Joshua. Each of us has come to Jesus openly, confessing our sins and declaring our complete need for salvation, and then our allegiance to Jesus. As such, he too has saved our lives from a certain death. But our relationship with Christ is so much better than that of a master and slave. Rather, we are, if we do God's will, reckoned as Jesus' brothers and sisters, called to be heirs of the kingdom when we shall serve him, not just as menial servants, as the Gibeonites did, but as kings and priests. Let us all pray for that time.